This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
I'm Hemant Mehta, and I'm flying solo today, and you're listening to the podcast for FriendlyAtheist.com. You can now listen to all of our episodes and see show notes at FriendlyAtheistPodcast.com. And by the way, we now have merchandise shop on the website, so if you want your podcast swag, and you know you do, go to our website and click on the store tab. Phil Torres is a philosopher and author who writes extensively about the intersection of religion and technology. He's a regular contributor at the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. His latest book is called The End: What Science and Religion Tell Us About the Apocalypse. So that sounds like a happy bedtime story. What's the deal? Are we all going to die or what?
That has yet to be seen. yesterday, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, their Science and Security Board, made a public announcement in which they said that they were leaving the doomsday clock, which is a metaphor for our sort of collective nearness to some sort of global catastrophe. Midnight represents doom or, you know, some sort of catastrophic occurrence, and the minute hand indicates how close we are. So they announced that we're still at 3 minutes before midnight, which is the second closest to 12 o'clock we've been in since the clock was first established in 1947. I think it was 1953 where it was 1 minute closer.
So we're pretty close. This is bad.
Go ahead.
So we're pretty close then. This is still pretty bad.
Yeah, they said there's some reasons for optimism, in particular the Iran nuclear deal, the Paris climate agreement are both steps in the right direction. But there are at the same time there are emerging technologies, many of which I discuss in the book in some detail, that are presenting completely novel risks. And at the same time, you know, global warming, you know, the Paris Agreement doesn't, there aren't really some, you know, robust mechanisms to enforce the agreement that was made. So there's still a bit of uncertainty in terms of, whether the climate is going to, we're going to be able to ameliorate that situation or it's going to continue to deteriorate.
So what should I be more worried about, I guess? Should I be more worried about the fact that nuclear weapons could get in the hands of the wrong people? Or should I be more worried about something like a virus that, I don't know, whether someone could create and then unleash upon the world?
It's pretty hard to say what one should worry more about. I did in the last chapter of the book. I do sort of rank, some of the biggest risks, which are called existential risks. In my judgment, something rather speculative, of perhaps the most speculative risk right now, which is superintelligence, quite possibly constitutes the greatest threat to the long-term survival of humanity.
And what is that? What is superintelligence?
So that just refers to a mind that has all the capacities of the human mind. So it's a general intellect, but it exceeds us in various domains. You know, beyond what is capable by the most intelligent human being.
So is this like artificial intelligence could come back to haunt us? Is that the sort of thing you're getting at?
Yeah. So there's actually superintelligence is a term that doesn't imply the material base, the material substratum of the intelligence. So it could be you could have a superintelligence that is instantiated in a biological organism. You know, I mean, there are cognitive enhancement technologies, there are brain machine interfaces, there are various, there's a technique called, which is still somewhat theoretical, called iterative embryo selection, which could result, studies have suggested, in humans with 140 extra IQ points than us. So it's possible, but I think most of the experts agree that superintelligence is much more likely to be implemented in some sort of silicon or carbon nanotubes, some sort of a material like that.
So what is it exactly that I have to fear if they're super smart?
Well, the idea is that, our sort of position at the pinnacle of earthly creation, if you will, is not due to sharp teeth or claws or our musculature or anything like that. It's almost entirely due to our intellectual capacities, along with certain enabling things like bipedalism and posable thumb. But so the idea is that if we were to lose that, we would be we'd be in a situation that we've probably never been in our history, where we're actually, second to another species, another kind of organism that is able to manipulate and rearrange the world in ways that, at the extreme, could utterly baffle us. A lot of theorists point out that we kind of have this notion of intelligence, which is very anthropocentric. You kind of have the village idiot, as it were, on one side, and then Einstein on the other. But really, when you're talking about the potential for artificial intelligence to think faster, to acquire a greater, much larger library of concepts than we have, the comparison isn't between Einstein and the village idiot, as it were. It's between an average human and a mouse or something. So you could imagine we'd be in quite a bad situation if you have an artificial mind that's thinking not at the biological speed of neurons in the brain, but instead at the essentially the speed of light, electrons moving around in hardware. And if it could grasp concepts, then we could be, it could potentially modify the world in ways that would utterly baffle us, in exactly the same way that a chipmunk scientist would be baffled at how it is that a voice of somebody in China is emerging from a device in New York.
So how far away are we from any of this? Because this seems really far-fetched, or at least way into the future. Is this anything we have to worry about right now?
No. Oftentimes, theorists have to distinguish between the pace of research in the field of artificial intelligence and then the rate at which a super intelligent computer would emerge. So it could be, by analogy, scientists worked for quite a while to create a nuclear chain reaction. But once the nuclear chain reaction happened, it was exponential. So I think a lot of the work has gone into whether or not a superintelligence would emerge exponentially. And there's a long history of people in AI making utterly, utterly wrong decisions about when an AI would first appear. And so I kind of shy away from that. I don't know. There was a poll done with a bunch of scientists in this particular field, and I think, if I remember correctly, probably 90% of them agreed before 2100. you know, within the century or something, you'd probably have it. But it's superintelligence, as I mentioned before, I mean, it's absolutely a speculative risk. There are much more concrete risks like global warming, biodiversity loss is a huge one, nuclear war, a designer pathogen or something created through synthetic biological techniques or, you know, biotechnology, genetic engineering, something of that sort.
So it almost sounds like an asteroid or something that you don't even notice, but as soon as you do, you're screwed. Like, it's going to hit you faster than you think.
Yeah. So I think with a lot of this, it's genuinely the case. If you talk to experts, there's a whole field that is burgeoning, was established probably about 15 years ago, called existential risk studies. And if you query the experts in this field, I mean, there is quite serious concern about the future. And even though these, you know, the idea is that a risk is the product of probability times consequences. So even if you have a low probability risk in the future, if the consequences are huge, the risk can still be quite significant. And I think that's the case when you're talking about human extinction or some sort of event that permanently prevents us from sort of evolving into, as it were, a post-human state or something that where we realize all of the extraordinary potential benefits of technology, like extended lifespan and, the absence of diseases and things of this sort.
Okay, so let's talk about religion. How does that play a role in all of this?
So the situation is complex but quite fascinating. While all of these technologies are being developed, there's a Pew poll from, I believe, just last year that predicts by 2050, 6 out of 10 individuals on Earth will either be Christian or Muslim.
Right, because they're breeding faster than the rest of us, and there's a lot of them to begin with.
Yes, precisely. Yeah, so say, you know, there's another study that predicted religion would essentially go extinct in 9 countries, the Czech Republic, New Zealand, Switzerland, and a few others, within the foreseeable future. And also the U.S., you know, the nuns, so-called nuns in the U.S. are increasing as well. So there's kind of, I would say there's sort of good news in the Western world, but Africa, China and so on. I mean, religion is sort of India. Religion is really sort of ballooning. So on the one hand, you have the idea is that religion is becoming more prevalent. At the same time, you have all of these technologies, with the exception of superintelligence, which could potentially be weaponized, but a lot of the fears don't have to do with the weaponization. A lot of the existential fears, that is, don't have to do with the weaponization of AI. But you have a lot of technologies like biotechnology, nanotechnology, and so on, that are not only becoming more powerful, but are also projected by virtually everybody to become more accessible as well. So at the extreme, you might have, you know, small groups or even lone wolves who are hidden beneath the surveillance horizon, working in their garage or whatever, who could potentially wreak unprecedented havoc on civilization. This is in part why the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists decided to keep the clock at 3 minutes till midnight, because you have all these emerging technologies that are empowering individuals.
So how does the afterlife play a role in all this? Because all of a sudden you have, this is a fear that I think a lot of people have expressed about religion, which is that you have people who are very pious, who really do believe that they want to be martyrs in this life, so they could get this wonderful afterlife. How does that play a role in all this? Because you have people who don't give a shit about their own lives, who may be willing, if they got the right weapons, they got the right tools, to take everyone else down with them. Is that a unique fear that religion brings to the table?
Yeah, so you're exactly right. I mean, the question is, who would want to employ advanced technology for the purpose of inducing some kind of global terminal catastrophe? And you could perhaps think of some, you know, really deranged psychopath individuals who simply just have a death wish for humanity, or, you know, want to get back at, want to get back at the world for some perceived injustice or something. But I would say the major issue is religious individuals who become convinced that you have to destroy the world in order to save it. And part of the book is about looking, you know, peering back across the vast expanses of human history and recognizing something that is quite clear once you sort of squint, but not a lot of people are aware that there's a huge history of active apocalyptic groups that saw themselves as active participants in an apocalyptic narrative that's unfolding in real time. So,
but those groups never had access to the sort of weapons we do now.
That is exactly, I mean, that's the crux of it. We're entering this new era where it is not hyperbole, it's not unfounded, it's not silly to say that the apocalyptic fantasies of these individuals could actually be realized at some point in the foreseeable future. So, I mean, you know, for example, just more recently, around the world today, synchronically speaking, you have the Islamic State, which is, an active apocalyptic group. They believe they're a catalyst in trying to effectuate, you know, various events before the last hour. You have the Eastern Lightning in China, which believes they're in an apocalyptic struggle with the communist government there. There's a Christian Identity movement in the U.S., which, unlike, I talk a lot about dispensationalists who are pre-millennialist, the Christian Identity movement is post-millennialist. So they believe that the world is going to get better and better before the second coming of Christ, which is the exact opposite of pre-millennialists. As part of that, they believe that the way to purify, cleanse, and so on the world is through catastrophic violence. So, I mean, they've been quite explicit about their desire to, you know, acquire nuclear weapons and use them to purify the world. You know, if you look 50 years ahead, you know, with exponential technological development, the Christian Identity movement could genuinely have access to what we might describe as doomsday machines. You know, whether biological in nature or nanotechnological or whatever. So it is the situation is changing. Every generation has waved their arms in the air and said, this is it, you know, the end is near and so on. But I don't think we should let that record fool us. A line I like to mention a lot is, repurposed a quote from David Hume, which is, you know, the wise person proportions her or his fears to the evidence. And when you do that, it seems that today we really are in quite a unique epoch where bad things really could come to pass.
So is there a way for us to win this battle? I mean, how do you talk common sense into people who have these visions of the afterlife?
Well, that's a great question. I address a few potential strategies for maximizing probability of an okay outcome for humanity in the last chapter of the book. Generally speaking, most of the proposals are somewhat fanciful, I would say. It's literally the case, you know, Elon Musk has said that there's a very strong humanitarian argument for colonizing space. And what he was referring to was essentially, mitigating the risk of existential catastrophe. Because, the wider out in space you are, the less likely is that a single accident of some sort is going to wipe everybody out. There are other options, like, you know, a lot of people, Stephen Hawking, Nick Bostrom, and so on, have suggested either explicitly or implicitly that if superintelligence isn't the absolute worst thing to ever happen to humanity, it will probably be the best thing. So some people talk about, well, you know, you could create this sort of super intelligent AI that it helps us to solve the global problems, climate change, biodiversity loss, terrorism, and so on, that are sort of haunting our future right now. And the other one that I think is perhaps quite interesting and that I find quite provocative is it comes from transhumanism, which is the idea that we not only can, but we ought to use technology to modify our phenotypes in various ways. So the idea there is I mentioned cognitive enhancing technologies earlier, perhaps there's some sort of modification you can make to, the particular architecture of the brain that would make us less likely to fall for certain kinds of, epistemologically unfounded delusions about the world, such as those relating to martyrdom and whatnot. So perhaps it's the case that, in order to actually survive, we need to go extinct. Not in the sense that the dodo did, but in a sense of replacing our species with something that is, in the relevant senses, better.
So are you optimistic, then, about the future?
that's a very tough question.
I asked the guy who writes about the apocalypse.
Yeah. Well, part of the reason I write about it is I feel like the first step to reducing the likelihood of some kind of extraordinary, historically unprecedented disaster is to recognize that the danger, is real. This claims made by scientists from climatologists to environmental scientists to those in the field of existential risk study, these claims are not like the claims of religion. I mean, throughout all of history, the tendency to, as I mentioned earlier, tendency to believe that an apocalyptic event is about to happen is quite ubiquitous across cultural space and time.
So people have had these worries for a long time. They haven't played out, but,
My understanding is, both Islam and Christianity borrowed quite heavily from Zoroastrianism. And Zoroastrianism probably itself began as an apocalyptic movement. And of course, many New Testament scholars today, the majority, as I understand it, believe that Jesus was a failed apocalyptic prophet. Others have said the exact same thing about Muhammad. They claim that he failed to designate a successor because he believed that the world was about to end. So, it's just, people all across history and geography have had this belief. There seems to be something deep in the human psyche that wants this weary world to come to an end and be replaced by something better. But these days, so I feel like there's a kind of the unfortunate consequence is people are a bit numb. I feel like to claims, to the crazy person on the street corner with the end is near kind of sign. But I genuinely think for philosophical or epistemological reasons, the claims being made today by scientists and philosophers are different in kind, and they really ought to be heeded. And in fact, some of them, like Sir Martin Rees, who runs the Center for the Study of Existential Risks at Cambridge University, he wrote in his 2004 or 2003 book called Our Final Hour that he believes it's essentially a 50-50 probability that we'll make it through. That's about the highest the most dire warning I've heard. Most are usually around like 25%, but even 25% is quite profound.
Right.
Yeah.
So we could read more about the ways that these things may harm us and maybe if there's any way to counter them. That's kind of the bulk of what this book is. It's called The End, What Science and Religion Tell Us About the Apocalypse. And there'll be a link to the book and everything in the show notes. Thank you so much, Phil, for joining me. And is there anything else I'm forgetting here? Anything else you want to add?
No, that's good. It was a real genuine pleasure to talk to you about this.
Awesome. Thank you so much for your time.
Okay, thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to the podcast for FriendlyAtheist.com. This episode was taped at Cinnamon Sound Studios in Aurora, Illinois. The music was composed by Brad Chagdis. If you like what you're hearing, please consider making a contribution at patreon.com/Hemant, that's He-Man T. We appreciate your support. And if you have any questions, feel free to email us at friendlyatheistpodcast@gmail.com. I'm Hemant Mehta, and I hope you'll join us next time.